We're talking about surviving debt, the evidence, the making the case for the perseverance of human consciousness after physical death. Leslie Kane wrote the book of Surviving Death and is also a co-producer of the Netflix series, the hit Netflix series that's up there now. And when we come back, we're going to get into mediums in some detail. Leslie's had some personal experience in dealing with mediums, and two of these six episodes in the series explores mediums, looks at which ones are legit and which ones are not. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Leslie Kane, over the years, I've interviewed a few mediums and channelers, by the way, and really often end up not impressed. The audience will come in with questions, and they just instantly turn it around as if automatically in touch with the spirits of departed loved ones, and they'll give an answer that's completely off and never miss a beat. You know, oh yeah, that your mom's dead. No, oh, it's your dad. Oh yeah, that's what I was getting. It's your dad, you know, and never miss a beat. And I've had the channeler, same kind of thing, where they always seem to have a upscale British kind of accent, as if all dead people are British. You have had your own personal experiences though with mediums, and you detailed them first in the book. Give me your take in general. I mean, obviously you think there's something to it.
Yeah, I think you're making a really good point though, George, that there are plenty. I think what you were describing is what we call cold readings, where mediums will, and they'll do this a lot with groups too, where they'll just sort of pick up cues from the sitter, and they'll kind of pick up body language, and they'll kind of make you think they're giving you information when you've really already given it to them. It's a whole technique, and it's recognizable. And I think what's important, first of all, is there are a lot of mediums that aren't very good, or that might even be trying to fool people, or, you know, but there's a lot of them that are just people with good intentions, but they don't really have an ability. And you just have to be very selective. For anybody that wants to have a reading, you've got to be very careful to find a really good medium. And the way to do that, I think, is to not only through word of mouth, through people that you know who have been to this medium, but as Ricky mentioned, there is an organization called Forever Family Foundation, and they've had a certification program for mediums. So if you go on their website and look at the list of mediums that they have, you at least know that these mediums have been tested through these fairly rigorous protocols that the organization has to screen out the mediums that can't pass those tests. And most of them don't pass. So you can start with a pool of mediums that you at least know have some ability. And there's another organization called the Winbridge Research Institute that does the same thing. So that's one way people can start to find a good medium. But you can't just jump in randomly and just go see anybody. You know, you've got to be selective about it. That's really, really important.
As I said, you had some personal experiences while working on the book, and you were careful to have sort of a blind test. You were careful to make sure that the mediums you were using could not know anything about you, but they produced results for you.
Yeah, I mean, I felt so blessed by the two readings that I had, which were the first readings I'd ever had with mental mediums before. They were both just extraordinary readings. And the first one was with Laura Lynn Jackson, who, if people who have seen Surviving Death, she does appear in the series and does a couple of readings for people, you know, as we film them. And the second medium I went to was Sandra O'Hara, who also is briefly in the series. I think I wish she had been in it a little bit more. But she's an extraordinary medium from Ireland who is actually available to do readings. Laura Lynn Jackson is not available. So I fortunately had back-to-back readings with them a couple of months in between. And, you know, with Sandra O'Hara particularly, but with Laura too, they didn't know who I was. I took out with Sandra a completely different email address. I had a friend actually email her on my behalf. And the email address had nothing to do with my name or anything like that. And then I just called her on the day of the reading on Skype, and she didn't know anything about me. So my jaw was dropping open, George. I'll tell you, the accuracy of the information that she brought through from two loved ones. One of them is Bud Hopkins, and the other one was my younger brother, who died in 2013 while I was actually writing my book. And I was just blown away by the, and I have it, I've written about it in my book, and I've listed the things that she said, and they were just stunningly accurate from both of these people. And she also portrayed their personalities very well. They were very different personalities, these two. And that came through in the reading as well. So when you have an experience like that, it really is absolutely wonderful. And but, you know, I've also been with meetings where that hasn't happened. So you can't always know. And some mediums that are great might have a bad day, or it just might not work out for whatever reason. So I encourage people to not give up if they don't have a great reading the first time. You'll find the medium that works for you if you're just persistent and you know, go to those websites and see the list of people that they have. But yeah, it was really, I had some very, very, very good experiences with very genuine, talented mediums. So I was lucky.
You know, in the series, you acknowledge that through history, there have been a lot of fraudsters, hoaxsters who've been caught in the act and have been analyzed. You also make the point, though, that while, you know, it's like counterfeit $100 bills, people know that there's one. That doesn't mean they're all fakes, you know, that there can be good ones. And you make the point that some of the greatest minds of, say, the 19th century were deeply interested in this. They thought the pursuit was valid scientifically. You had a couple of Nobel Prize winners and the Curies, Mark Twain, William James. It was very powerful to see all those names and to think that they were interested in this phenomena so long ago.
I agree with you, George. I think it's really an important point that most people don't realize. And for them, we're talking also about physical mediumship, which is even harder for people to comprehend that it could have any reality to it. Most people just think all physical mediums were just fraud, but it's actually not the case. And like you said, many of them were, but that's irrelevant, really. What we're interested in are the cases where they're genuine. And the way we know that is because, as you mentioned, very sophisticated scientists, and one of them was a Nobel Prize winner by the name of Charles Richer from France. I mean, he was a physiologist well known in the world of science, published all these papers and was a leading light in his field and a Nobel Prize winner. And he was really interested in studying these physical mediums, and he would take them into controlled conditions so that he could eliminate any possibility of fraud, because with the right controls, you can do that. And he documented some of these genuine physical mediums that could produce very amazing phenomena. So those are the cases I'm absolutely fascinated by them, because if you read the papers and books that these individuals wrote about their work, their studies, you know that these mediums were not frauds. These were very astute investigators trained at recognizing fraud. They'd already probably, you know, outed many, many mediums before the ones that they found that were genuine. So, and there were other scientists as well. And this was back in the early 1920s, 1930s and 40s. The Society for the British SPR, Society for Psychical Research, was very well known at having a huge group of scientists that were doing this kind of work. So I think people need to realize this is not just sort of some flighty kind of new agey thing. This is something that has been studied for over 100 years by very astute scientists. And there's a lot of fascinating information based on these studies, which I've written about in my book, and I've got footnotes, but I've also just summarized them for people. And I think if you read my section on physical mediumship in my book, you'll come to understand that there really is some reality to this. And most people really don't know that. I'm fascinated by physical mediumship because of the miraculousness of what happens and the fact that that has been documented. And I've also witnessed it for myself. So I'm particularly interested in that part of mediumship and trying to learn more about that.
What did you see?
Well, I sat with a medium from the UK. His name is Stuart Alexander. He's now in his mid-70s. He's been working as a medium for 40, maybe 50 years now. quietly with a small group of people year after year after year developing his abilities. And when I've sat with him, and again, I've made sure that all conditions of fraud, I mean, he's never been caught in fraud, and I made sure the room was secure and all the things you need to do. I don't want to bore people with it, but I did all the things you need to do to check out the, you know, that there's nothing going on that shouldn't be going on. And so he is a kind of phenomena that occur with him, which are very kind of common among, you know, physical mediums, is things like the levitation of things in the room. There's a thing called a trumpet, which is like a cone-shaped megaphone type thing. That can be levitated. Voices will come out of it when it's floating in the air. It'll fly around the room. It'll touch people. It'll go to the ceiling. It'll move around. And that's one thing. Sometimes there are independent voices that come from parts of the room independently of the medium. There are spirit controls that speak through the body of the medium. This process of physical medium involves the medium going into a trance state. And the way Stuart describes it is, it's sort of like he's not, you know, he's unconscious, basically. He goes into a trance. He's not aware of anything that's happening. And then he comes back at the end. And while he's gone, these spirit controls, these beings from the spirit world, as is how he perceives what's going on, come through his body and speak through his vocal cords. And they have distinct personalities. There's a group of about five of them that have been working with him for a long time. And I've, you know, you get to know them kind of like they're friends of yours. But the really extraordinary physical phenomena, when you have voices that can speak independently of the medium. So they're like in some other part of the room. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. You also have the materialization of things. There's actually a living hand that materializes in Stuart's seance room, and many people have witnessed this. So he's actually been levitated himself in his chair. There's also experiments they do with Matt where they call it matter through matter, where they can pull Stuart's arm. This is the spirit team that works with him through a cable tie. So his arm will go right through solid matter. It's just a lot of phenomenal things. But another important part of his mediumship, though, which he feels is really the most important part, is the communications that can be provided to sitters with their loved ones on the other side when these loved ones are brought through his mediumship, similar to the way they would be with a mental medium, where people can actually sometimes speak directly to their loved ones, which is really extraordinary, if their loved ones are able to communicate through Stuart, which isn't always easy for them. So,
in the series, you go to look at the notes and papers of that organization you mentioned, this Society for Psychical
right.
Research.
And talking about the Cambridge University Library?
Yes, yeah. And yeah. It's very impressive. And then, you know, along the way, you introduce the idea of ectoplasm, which, you know, most people will know from the movie Ghostbusters. But there's this one particular artifact, or I guess artifacts, where hands go into this stuff, and it's produced out of nowhere. So the scientists who are involved in this research, as you describe it, they're surrounding the medium. They got their hands on them. They're not going to be tricked. And these amazing things happen, and you show these artifacts, these hands, that were produced out of nowhere. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you're talking about the mold made from
the paraffin,
PVC,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these to me, George, are among the most important evidence, if not the most important evidence that we have for the reality of the fact that materializations can occur. And the reason these are so important is because you had these two astute scientists. One of them was the Nobel Peace Prize winner that I mentioned, Charles Richet, who took this physical medium named Franek Kluski, who had all kinds of physical phenomena going on in his seance room. It's just extraordinary. Putting that aside, they took him into a laboratory in their facility in Paris that had no windows. It was completely under the control of the investigators. He came in there. They sat with him. They held his feet and his hands so that he couldn't possibly move around the room. And these spirit beings, or however you want to call them, would materialize in the room. And these investigators brought in hot wax, a bowl of very, very hot wax, into the seance room that was kept hot by a boiling water under it. And they ask the spirit people, the spirit materializing forms, to dip their hands into the wax, which they did. And the people in the room were able to hear it. Sometimes they could see lights where the hands, because usually these rooms were dark. But this, with him, they had a low light on, and people could see the sparkling lights around these hands, and they could hear the wax being, you know, moved around by the hands. And then the wax would drip around the room. And after the wax dried on the hands, the materialized hand would dematerialize and drop this very thin wax glove of a hand on somebody's lap or on a table in the room. And so afterwards, they were left with these wax gloves, and they were very thin. Sometimes you had two hands that were interlocked, or, you know, fingers that were bent and things like that, so that there'd be no way that a physical hand could slide itself out of these wax gloves without damaging them. The only way the gloves could remain intact was if the hand dematerialized, and you could see that by the way that the gloves looked. And so it's just extraordinary, and these people had real control over what was going on. They were then able to take these wax gloves, and then they would pour, porcelain or whatever it is that they use to make the solid mold. So they have like these statues, and then they could peel the wax off, and you'd have a perfect replication of this materialized hand. And this is evidence for the fact that this actually happens. And one of the other really interesting elements about these molds, what we call them, the molds from Kosky, is that some of them were child size, which made them even more evidential. There were no children in the room. I mean, nobody in the room was doing this anyway, but the fact that they were child size, so you could have an adult-looking hand. It didn't look pudgy like a little kid's hand. It was an adult-looking hand, but it was the size of a child's hand. So this is also really interesting, you know. I mean, and these astute scientists vouched for everything that happened, and they had the strictest control to know that nothing was brought into the room. They would put this dye in the wax that nobody else knew was in the medium, and maybe the few other sitters in the room didn't know that this dye was in the wax, and so they could correlate the molds that they had, so that, you know, to prove that nobody brought anything in. I mean, it was. I could go on and on. There's so much detail as to how they control these experiments that there's no way that this didn't actually happen the way they described it. And they wrote a detailed book about it, with detailed descriptions of every single session and what they did. I find it absolutely fantastic that you can actually see. I went to Paris and I was able to witness these and touch these molds. And I found it was very meaningful for me to be able to do that.
After your experiences with mediums to connect with Bud and your brother, do you need mediums to do it? Have you had any other contact with either of those spirits?
Well, I mean, the mediums made a huge difference. I think when you sit with a medium, it kind of opens a door for you, and then maybe you will be getting more direct communications after that. And I think with my brother was sending me a lot of communications and things, but that's how I interpret it. And some of them happen before the reading, and some of them happen after the reading. And, you know, the medium would validate, you know, some things that might have happened 3 weeks ago that my brother had done, which I might have, of course, questioned, was that really him? But then she would bring it up in a reading and reference it without me saying anything. Or she would say, you know, here's the sign you're going to have with your brother. Something's going to happen with this. And, you know, so there's a whole lot of doors that open for you to have your own direct communications. And that's what we call after-death communications, where you can have these contacts without a medium. And many, many people do. I'm sure many people listening right now have had these experiences where you might sense the person suddenly being in the room. You might have a smell that you associate with them.
We got to go to a break. Sorry to interrupt, Leslie. We'll come back to that. Talking with Leslie Cain about surviving death. So what happens to us after we die? Is that it? Is that the end? Or does part of us go on? Leslie Cain, my guest, is exploring that in the new Netflix series, which is also the title of a book she wrote on it, Surviving Death. We have a lot of ground still to cover in our final segment. I want to ask one UFO-related question, then we'll open up the phone line so you can talk to Leslie about her investigations into these matters, a life-changing events. So the people who have these experiences, who connect with the other side, say they no longer fear death. You knew that I was going to have to play that Blue Oyster Cult song in this program somewhere. So we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM, and then we'll take a couple of calls and questions from you in a moment. Leslie, before we go to the phones, two other questions. One is returning to the subject of reincarnated kids. They come out with these incredible stories. They're terrorized. And I'm trying to remember what the phrases were that at least one of these kids used in your series, that they kind of intimate that they're not supposed to talk about it, that it's against the rules for them to reveal this stuff. And it made me wonder, you know, what's going on there? What are the rules? Why do some people come back? And does it mean we all do or only some? And then it makes me also wonder how many cases there are here in the West, in the U.S., in religious households where the parents just tell them to shut up. This is demonic. I don't want to hear about it. And then the kids eventually outgrow it and the memories fade.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that happens, George, because, you know, even with the kids we cover, there was one parent who was very resistant to it. So if you've got two parents, I mean, many, many times the kids are told, oh, you're just dreaming. It's just a dream. And then it sort of shuts down. The kid might give a few other memories, but the parents think it's just sort of fantasy and they don't think anything of it. So it's the parents that have the alertness and the awareness of the sort of strangeness of what's happening and that kind of allow their child to express it. They're not pushing them to do it, but like with these children, it just comes out very naturally at the moments when the child feels like, or somehow it comes up. So yeah, I'm sure, especially in this culture, George, there are so many families that because of their attitudes, the child never really comes out with all of it, and it just gets buried. I think there are other cultures, of course, where it's more accepted, like in, you know, Asian countries, India and Burma and places like that. And those were the countries that the research was originally done on these cases by Ian Stevenson from the University of Virginia, because in those cultures there was a freedom for people to talk about it because it's part of their belief system. So that makes it easier, but that's not the case in this country. So we don't know how many times it happens that the cases are shut down, but I'm sure it happens quite a lot.
One UFO question. You know, you and your colleagues wrote that story December 2017. I haven't talked to you on the air about since then, but, you know, it's changed the UFO subject forever. So many ripples that we're still feeling. Could you just share with us what the experience was like and seeing what a profound effect it's had on this subject that you've covered for so long?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really, really exciting. I mean, that story, you know, for me as a journalist who've been covering UFOs for 20 years and to suddenly, or, you know, it had been about 20 at that time, to suddenly be breaking news on the front page of the New York Times, news that was really significant. It was like the pinnacle of my career as a journalist. I mean, I'd never had a moment like this. It was absolutely life-changing, really. It was wonderful to see the effect that it had. I mean, I'm just so glad that, you know, the story was able to change things the way it has. And I think the subsequent stories we did also, the one a year later about the Roosevelt cases also had a big effect, you know, where the Navy was actually willing to acknowledge that these things were happening and we got Freedom of Information Act, you know, reports from those cases. Yeah, I mean, it's been really an amazing ride, George, and it was just thrilling and exciting, hard work. But really, really thrilling to see what had happened with it. I don't know how else to describe it.
And how is the New York Times on this topic now in general? I mean, for, you know, decades ago, you'd see a story or two here and there that they'd take right down the middle seriously. And then it was sort of a forbidden topic for a long time. I can imagine what a heavy lift it was to get this through the editors. And I've heard stories about pushback. I know that, you know, looking at the readership, the reactions, that these were highly read stories that they must have made a dent, and people realized at the paper that, wow, this topic is of interest to the public. But I tend to doubt that they're diehard, want to assign a UFO story every month.
No, exactly. I mean, there's a very, very high bar at the New York Times. And that's one of the reasons that the stories carry so much weight. You know, you can't just sort of go in and write about the latest thing like you might be able to do in a blog or something. You know, it's got to have a lot of meat to it. It's got to be government related. It's got to be something really new and exciting. You know, it's got to be groundbreaking. Those are the kinds of stories that they'll go for. But so we are, my colleague Ralph Blumenthal and I are always looking for what we could bring next to the New York Times. But we know that most of the stuff we run across, we're not going to be able to bring to the New York Times. It's really frustrating. So we have to get it at a certain level that to interest the editors there. And but they're always they're interested. I mean, they want additional stories on this topic. So we have definitely changed the attitudes at the New York Times. They are now recognizing this is a valid subject worthy of coverage, and they're willing to do more of it as long as we can find the stories that they feel to be worth it, you know, at the level that the Times needs them to be at. And so that's our task.
Let's take a couple of calls. West of the Rockies, John in Oregon. Hi, John. You're on with Leslie Kane.
Hi. How are you today?
We're good. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question for your guest. First, I want to tell you what happened to my dad and my uncle. My dad died, and before he died, he kept saying, "Mother, Mommy, I love you. Mommy, I love you." I thought he was talking to my mother. When his brother died, my cousin's wife told me that he raised up his head and looked at the foot of his bed and seen my dad and seen his mother. Now, that tells me that my dad, when he died, he seen his mother. I thought he was talking to my mother. Now, my question is to your guest, 10 or 15 seconds before you pass away, do we go into another dimension where we can see the afterlife?
Well, I mean, thank you for the question. I'm not in a position to answer, you know, something like that, like every time what happens and at the last moments. I just know that the situation you're describing where these people close to death will say and they'll see their loved ones coming in to assist them. So they'll, you know, they will have these experiences of contacting people from the other side the closer they get to death. So there's seems to be definitely some kind of connection that is being made with the other side. And whether that happens, you know, right before somebody dies or maybe in the days prior to when they die, I don't think we really know. And I think every case is different. But there are many, many cases well documented, and we have some of them in the series Surviving Death, of people with these kinds of visions and connections that do occur where they, you know, they'll see their loved ones coming over. It's just much more common than people realize.
Thanks for the call, John. First-time caller line, Scott in Decatur, Illinois. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Long-time listener. I've had, since the age of two, I've had recurring nightmares of drowning in a 20-foot wall of mud and water. And my entire family was in the car. And I'm shortening it for the time a while, but we're trying to outrun it, and I always knew it was set in the 30s somewhere, but I wasn't sure about the time period, and I recognized the car and everything, and my father's driving it, my mother's holding me on the front seat, I'm six, and a girl, I'm actually a guy in this life, and I thought they were related, but I wasn't sure about that, but I found out later they were friends of the family. That a boy and a girl, they were brother and sisters, in the back seat. And
So, Scott, you're saying that you've had this as a recurring dream or recurring memory, and then you found out that it really happened?
Yes. by the time I was 2 months, I mean 2 years old, is when I started having the nightmares. And the time I was four, it escalated. It showed me how I died in it, the memory. And I would wake up screaming my head off, saying I died. I was hugging my foot post of the bed to keep from being swept away by the water in the drain. And my stepdad come in there, and he would get mad and say, "Oh, you're not dying, you're all right." And my parents didn't know how to take that, you know. They were kind of simple country people, not over-religious, but just, you know, didn't know how to take that. But my older sister was way more open, and she knew because she was around me more. But it stayed all that way. Believe it or not, I've had them about once or twice a month all the way up till age 15. From age 15 about 22, I only had them every so sporadically. But it never wavered. I could, but I also have an eidetic memory retention system. I can actually tell you what they were wearing, the colors, the feel of the warm breeze in the air that night, and everything. I mean, in great detail. And also the great fear, that was more than anything. And it's affected me my entire life. I'm 50 years old now. And last year, I had been looking for years, and I never could find anything with a car. I put down family of five die by flash flood or flood. Couldn't find nothing. And I was watching a YouTube channel called Hollywood Cemetery, and he goes around and all the actors and stuff give a little their stories of their lives. Well, he stumbled across two twin boys, and he said they died in Montrose, California. The second I heard that word Montrose, it triggered a memory in me, and I run into my computer, and I typed that in, and the car I was looking for popped right up. And I kept one little indention away from everybody. I called a guy that had written a book on this. His name was Mike Lawler out of L.A., and he did some research for me, and near the end, he said, I think you're not telling me everything. And I said, yeah, I got one little piece here. And when the water hit the car, it pushed us hard. It come up over the back of the hood of the car, and it popped out the back window, water come in. And I remember glass getting hit with a teenage boy. I'm saying he's about 20, 21. But he got hit in the back of the head, and his sister screamed. Now, it starts really filling up the car, and then the car, the water coming around the side of the car, comes in the driver's side first, and my mom panicking, telling him to go faster, and it's too late, and the passenger side gets filled up, and a suction rips me out of my mother's arms, and I'm going out the passenger window, and my mom, the last bit of it, she had her hand tips all the way wrapped around my hand tips, like you're doing a reverse grip. And I finally had to let go. Our fingers slipped through each other. And I was washed away under the muddy water. And the thing is, I didn't panic. I felt calm, peaceful even. I knew I was going to die. And as I started to slowly take in water, I could look up and see light above. And when the last bit of water that hit me, that left my lungs, I felt my body leave, my soul leave my body. And I started swimming towards the light, and I come up out of the water, and I could see the devastation everywhere. I mean, water up the eaves of the house, halfway up the trees, and just everywhere you look. I'm going to say at least a 10 miles or more stretch. And
I tell you what, Scott.
I felt the tug it was pulling me towards the light, and things just started speeding up. I head straight into that light, and that's the last thing I remember. It always ends that memory always ends this way. Well, when he helped me and he found me the bodies, he told me, "Well, you something you would tell from me." I said, "The little girl wasn't found in the car, was she? She was found downstream, wasn't she?" And I'm thinking her arm was above ground because I always got that feeling. And he goes, "You're right. She was found about a mile and a half downstream from where her family was. Her own uncle dug her body up only because he did find her arm from elbow up."
Oh,
and they did
Scott, it's a great story, but we have to go on. We have some other callers here. I want to wrap things up with Leslie, but thanks for sharing. You might want to leave your number with our call screener, Donna, and Leslie might want to get in touch with you for future research. But thanks for calling. That's a heck of a story. Leslie, the description that Scott has about the peaceful feeling, he's not panicking or anything, you hear that a lot.
Yeah, it's actually what Mary Neal said in the series. The woman who drowned, she was also underwater, which is what he's describing. She was pinned under a boat, a kayak under the water, and her bones were breaking, and she just felt, she said she felt peaceful. She felt no fear. And then she felt her soul kind of peel away from her body, very similar to what Scott was just describing. It's really interesting.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Scott. Try to get one more in. Charles in Newark, Ohio. Hi, Charles.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to...
We have like 2 minutes left, so just let you know.
Okay, I'll try to make this real quick. My aunt, which Aunt Donna is also Donna, spiritual, so I want to mention her name so the spirit guides will get this out. But she always explained to me when different family members would pass away, that they didn't know they passed away, and they would wander around wondering why certain people would not respond to them, like my Uncle George and stuff. So my question is, even as we speak now, those beings do not live in time because they have already expired their time. So that being that they're not in time, they're experiencing time, does that make them time travelers that they can actually right now be at this moment hearing and experiencing our conversation?
All right. Thanks for the question. We'll have Leslie's reaction to that.
Oh, my gosh. I don't think I can answer that question, yeah. George. Maybe you can.
Well, you in your series, you have a couple of people who say that over on that side, they have no sense of time. They don't even think time exists,
true.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what he's asking. He says time traveling. But, no. Yeah, I mean, it seems many people report that the perception of time is totally different when you're in that realm. There really isn't any time. They sort of say that, you know, they're experiencing the past and the future and the present all at the same time. And there's just no sense of this sort of mechanical forward motion of time the way we experience it here. So that's all I can really say. I think he might have been talking about something more complicated than that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thanks to our callers. We didn't have a chance to go into all the material that's covered in the series, which does not include all the material that's covered in the book. That gives us a chance to talk about this again sometime. It's the ghosts and hauntings and EVPs, and then the episode on synchronicity type events. It's fascinating stuff. I can see why it's such a big hit on Netflix. And Leslie, I can't thank you enough for being here. Good luck with the series and the book, and I hope there's another one, a follow-up.
Well, thank you. I hope so too, George. I just wanted to mention that I'm putting a brand new page on my website with a lot of material about mediumship that was not included in episodes 2 and 3, and I think it will help people get a much better understanding of what mediumship's all about. So I would just, and anyway, I just want to announce that I'm launching that page tomorrow, and I hope that a lot of people will check it out.
Great. I think we got links to your site on Coast to Coast, so I encourage our listeners to check it out. Thanks, Leslie. Talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thank you very much, George.
And thank you also to Ricky Stern. Coming up next, Dr. Avi Loeb, Oumuamua, the strange interstellar visitor that popped up a couple of years ago, still being debated.